This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, this is a call being made by the European Union Ombudsman to member states.
Reveal the human rights impact assessment that you've done. And we've also said to them, you know, what are you going to do in relation to the funding if you find out that human rights violations have occurred? And you know, what are they going to do in relation to the future monitoring of human rights abuses? Because they cannot hide from the reality of it.
This comes as allegations of human rights abuses against undocumented migrants continue in places like Tunisia and Libya. And as the world commemorates the 80th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, one of the biggest death camps in which millions of Jews were murdered alongside other minority groups in Germany during the Second World War, we hear the story of a black man from Tanzania who also perished in one of those camps.
He was sent to the concentration camp in 1941. For a long time, the Nazis, they didn't show interest as long as he served their politics to claim the colonies back.
It's Monday, the 27th of January. First, we go to the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Heavy fighting, bombing and artillery fire continues in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo. The M23 rebel group says it has taken Goma, a strategic city by Lake Kivu. They are said to have done this with the help of Rwandan troops. The United Nations has condemned what it called the unauthorized presence of external forces in the region. The different fighting groups have been trying to assert their dominance by giving each other ultimatums to withdraw or lay down their arms. Humanitarian agencies say aid workers are risking their lives to give food and medicine to those affected by the conflict. Over the weekend, 9 South Africans, 3 Malawians and 1 person from Uruguay were among peacekeepers killed in the fighting. On the diplomatic side, Kenya has called an emergency regional summit.
We will be convening an extraordinary East African Community Summit within the next 48 hours to facilitate and to deliberate on this crisis and chart a way forward. This is in line with the East African Community Summit's decision of November 2024, which called for constructive engagement to address this conflict.
President William Ruto of Kenya. He went on to say that the Congolese and Rwandan presidents have agreed to take part. But what is going on? Our Africa region news editor, Will Ross, has been following events.
Well, despite the international concern at the UN Security Council and calls for the M23 rebels not to advance on Goma, that's exactly what happened. It was a pretty lively weekend in terms of diplomatic goings on at the UN Security Council, as well as what was happening on the ground in eastern Congo. People will say a lot of this diplomatic pressure came very late, seeing as about 400,000 people had been displaced just during the month of January. Suddenly, when the rebels were at the door of Goma, they called an emergency Security Council meeting, and there was wide condemnation of not only the M23 for trying to seize the city, but also a lot of criticism of Rwanda and kind of openly saying, Rwanda, you need to pull your troops out of Congo and get back to the peace table.
It seems like a very sudden, very rapid, very hard push. Why?
There are different ways of looking at it. I think possibly these rebels and their backers, Rwanda, were thinking, well, the world is distracted. Donald Trump's inauguration is going on. America hasn't yet got going with its kind of engagement in Africa, whereas Joe Biden was engaged to a degree. They were pushing for those peace talks that broke down, the ones that Angola was mediating. So while the world's distracted, a good chance for the M23 to keep taking these swathes of territory so that if they get back to peace talks, they'll be talking from a position of huge strength.
Rwanda has long denied being involved with the M23, which is the militia that is behind this fighting. So what has forced them out into the open like this? What's changed?
From Rwanda's point of view, over the weekend, it was interesting that the Rwandan diplomat who spoke, he did not deny supporting the rebels, but stressed that the whole problem here is the world not paying attention to the root causes of the conflict. And Rwanda all along has said its concern, number one concern, is the security of its country. And as long as there are Hutu rebels in eastern Congo, it has the right to defend itself and has in the past said it has the right to go over the border and make sure the country is safe. But the big question is, how much of a threat is this Hutu rebel group, the FDLR, which is linked to the Rwandan genocide? Is it really a threat to Rwanda? Or does the Kigali government use it as a kind of excuse for carrying out what people say is a expansionist agenda to try and seize areas of eastern Congo that are rich in minerals that will be a huge help to the Rwandan economy?
And Rwanda, of course, also says that the Congolese government is not able to rescue its state. It's a failed state, essentially, and it's blaming Rwanda. And Rwanda always says it's a small country. Congo is one of the biggest countries in Africa. Where is the Congolese army in all of this?
Well, the Congolese army does not have a very good reputation. It basically turned to lots of different militias in order to try and fight the M23. And amongst those militias were the FDLR. So Rwanda says, how on earth can the Congolese army be working with this Hutu militia against the M23? How can you be working with them when you're supposed to be neutralizing this group, disarming them? And it has created a very bizarre situation where Felix Tshisekedi turned to southern African countries and said, come and help. South Africa sent troops, as did other southern African countries, including Malawi. Some of those peacekeepers were killed just in the last few days. But it's quite odd that South African troops find themselves supporting an army which is working with militia. And the same could be said for the UN MONUSCO peacekeepers.
And they have been there for a very long time, and they're a huge force as well.
They're a huge force. They are supposed to be protecting the civilian population. They're supposed to be using force when they're under threat. But they have obviously been seen by Rwanda and the M23 as taking sides. So that puts the UN in a pretty difficult situation. And interestingly, over the weekend, the Rwandan diplomat at the UN Security Council accused the UN of being complicit in the Congolese army and the Hutu militia's attempts to cause regime change in Rwanda, an extraordinary claim, which many people would say is kind of convenient, but it shows that they're basically accusing the UN of being very partisan in this.
So where do we stand now? Things are changing very rapidly, I know, but we're talking on Monday morning. Is fighting still continuing? What's happening with people fleeing? What's happening with initiatives to actually bring some sort of order to it?
It's been a mixed picture. I think the fact that President Felix Tshisekedi held a security meeting late on Sunday and stressed that the priority was protecting civilians, it suggests the army, if not deciding to let the M23 take Goma, certainly weren't going to put all of their effort into fighting to hold on to it, because they knew that the 1 to 2 million people living in Goma would be at huge risk if there was an all-out battle for the city. There have been pockets of resistance even after the M23 rebels marched into the center of Goma. There were also, early on Monday morning, reports of some gunfire back and forth across the border, which is a worrying development.
But the border with Rwanda?
The Congolese border with Rwanda. But I think at this stage, it looks as though the M23 are going to get their goal of having Goma. And for the civilians, they've got nowhere to flee to. The border was shut.
And there were so many hundreds of thousands of other refugees that had come to Goma, right?
Exactly. And many of them were living in camps on the outskirts. So over the weekend, we saw them moving further into the center of Goma. And it's this kind of continual mass displacement, because we're talking a lot about the politics and the battles going on, but decades of upheaval for the civilian population. And when we see women and children and men, but a lot of women and children on the move, carrying water cans, carrying cooking pots, moving to wherever they think they're going to be safe. And because this has been such a fast-moving conflict, that's been really difficult for civilians to know where to head to.
Who has the potential to bring everybody around the table to stop the fighting and to settle the situation? The Ugandan president, Yoweri Museveni, used to have some sway in the region. Where is he in all of this?
Well, the last UN expert's report said that Uganda was also giving some help to the M23 rebels. There is a school of thought that a deal between Kinshasa and President Museveni that allowed the Congolese army to work with the Ugandan army to take on another rebel group, the ADF, and contracts for the Ugandans to build roads, etc., that was a kind of turning point that saw Rwanda get annoyed that it was being cut out of deals. So President Museveni's not seen as a neutral in this. As I said earlier, I don't think William Ruto is particularly either. So the Luanda process that was organized by the Angolan president but pushed heavily by the Biden administration, that was kind of seen as having the best hope. Now I think a lot of people are waiting to see what officials in Donald Trump's administration do, because France has been very outspoken, hugely critical of Rwanda, but frankly, France has lost a lot of its influence in Africa, and Rwanda may take the view that we don't really care what messages come out of Paris. We care if it gets much bigger than that, because if America takes action, other countries and the EU may follow suit. And if we go back to 2012, when the rebels briefly took the city of Goma again, there were sanctions put on Rwanda. Rwanda pulled back the support. The M23 were pushed out, and then that stayed like that for years in limbo, with the rebels all pushed away from eastern Congo into camps in Uganda and Rwanda. So international pressure can have a big impact on Rwanda's hand in this, but it just depends where it comes from.
That's Will Ross, South Africa Region News Editor. A report by the European Union Ombudsman has raised serious concerns about the way in which Tunisia is using money given to it by the EU Commission to stop undocumented migration into Europe. The report investigated whether member countries were practicing what they preach in terms of safeguarding human rights by carrying out checks and balances on how their money is spent. Details of all their findings have not yet been released, but I have been speaking to the ombudswoman who conducted the report. We'll hear more from her in a moment, but the abuses, long and well documented, include sexual violence, trafficking, abuse and exploitation of children, and collusion with people smugglers. Emily O'Reilly has served as European Ombudsman.
We had done investigations of this type before, looking at the various deals that the EU enters into internationally. And what we have checked in the past is whether the human rights obligations are being adhered to. For example, several years ago, we looked at whether the EU, the Commission, had done a human rights impact assessment with the EU-Vietnam trade agreement. They hadn't, in fact, and so we were very critical of them for that. So obviously, migration and asylum issues have been a very major issue for the EU and elsewhere in the world. And so when this controversial deal, shall we say, the Memorandum of Understanding, as they call it, emerged in roughly July, I think, of 2023 between the EU and Tunisia, we decided we would, on our own initiative, take a look at that and to see whether they had carried out a human rights impact assessment before they signed on the dotted line.
And what did you find? Had they?
Well, Yeah, it's a bit paradoxical, actually, because initially they said, no, we didn't. And we said, well, why didn't you? And they said, because we didn't have to, because it's a memorandum of understanding and there are no legally binding commitments in the understanding. And therefore, according to their logic, the interpretation of the law, they didn't need to do one.
So what did you find was contained in the report? I know that we report about this regularly. We report about the hardening of attitudes in Tunisia, the rapes and torture and summary almost executions of people in the desert, dumping them with no recourse, no food, no water. But I'm wondering whether it was actually reported in such stark detail in the reports.
We will all find out when those reports are published, and hopefully they will be. When we do our investigations, certain of our findings are confidential until the end, shall we say. We are hoping and expecting that the Commission will publish its reports when it reports back to us next month.
You're quite constrained, aren't you, in this? And you did intimate earlier that this is a very emotive political issue in the EU. I wonder what effect will that have on sanctions against people who may have been complicit in hiding human rights abuses or even helping to perpetrate them within the EU?
Well, I mean, this is a huge ethical issue for the EU. On the one hand, it brands itself, if you like, and markets itself on the basis of its adherence to very strong human rights values. And in many cases, that is absolutely true. On the other hand, the politics of migration and asylum are so fraught at the moment. On the one hand, they sign these deals and they give money to administrations or countries, regimes such as the one in Tunisia, in order effectively to stop migrants coming to Europe. But then they cannot turn a blind eye to the ways in which the regime prevents migrants from coming to Europe. I mean, the figures now show that the fewer people are coming to Europe from certain of the trajectories, if you like, the ways that people make the journey to the Mediterranean, for example. So great, the figures are down. The policy is working. But the question to be answered, well, why are the figures down? And obviously reports such as you guys have done and The Guardian have done have shown why. Because in many cases, migrants are being abused, pushed back, and so on. And that is the way in which they are prevented from coming to Europe. And the question for the EU is whether they can stand over that, give them the money, cross their fingers, hope the hell that migrants and asylum seekers aren't abused while in course of this. But thankfully, the media and others are still there to show what is happening. And, you know, the EU obviously feels very uneasy about being essentially complicit in this.
So what recommendations have you made to the EU Commission in light of what you revealed?
The report revealed the human rights impact assessment that you've done. You know, that is accountability, and accountability or transparency that are words that are much used throughout the EU administration. And we've also said to them to say, what are you going to do in relation to the funding if you find out that human rights violations have occurred? What exactly will be stopped? What will happen to the funding in relation to that? And you know, what are they going to do in relation to the future monitoring of human rights abuses? Because they cannot hide from the reality of it.
And that's Emily O'Reilly, European Ombudswoman. Tunisia is in the crosshairs, but other North African countries are also being blamed for these abuses. EU countries, which have been funding projects to keep undocumented migrants away from Europe, are now under pressure to pay closer attention to how people are treated when these policies are being enforced. So has there been a change in the way the Tunisian government has been treating undocumented arrivals? Elisia Folkman is a journalist in Tunisia.
What's sort of interesting in what has been in the press is very much putting Tunisia forward as being an ideal partner for different African nations like Mauritania. There's been a lot of diplomatic activity, and Tunisia is desperately trying to present itself as an ideal place to invest in. So I think rather than in the past where side has been very reactive, they're playing it down and sort of ignoring it.
The EU ombudsman was demanding that EU countries reveal the human rights lapses that they have spotted in Tunisia. And with it comes something of a threat that if those conditions are not met, that, you know, money might be withheld. Would Tunisia respond to such a threat at all in a positive way?
No. Given the government and the president's sort of previous reactions, they would be probably quite hostile. Saïd has repeatedly rebuked that Tunisia commits human rights violations. What he's previously said on many occasions is that, you know, Tunisia treats migrants with all human care and respect for human rights. If we look back to last year with the notorious deal, he was quite pugnacious in dealing with the EU. And what triggered them, the EU, to come running with bags of cash was a large flotilla of migrant boats that landed on Lampedusa in September of 2023. It was about 75 boats, so it completely overwhelmed the little island and the Italian services.
Why is it, though, that human smugglers and traffickers continue to operate in Tunisia, in spite of the fact that all this money is going into trying to stop it?
The thing is that there is a massive multi-million, possibly even multi-billion euro business, and there's a supply chain that is established. So you've got the supplying smugglers who are working out of West Africa through the Sahel, and they're pushing people ever northwards towards Tunisia and Libya. And they're still selling, you know, the Bouza free idea. You will be lucky one who'll get across. But more and more, it's kind of become more like the Squid Game, really. The risks and the loss of life is so huge now, even before you leave the shores of Tunisia and Libya. It's incredibly dangerous, but that's not putting people off. And what we're seeing, certainly with other trafficking routes, is that there's a lot of promotion on social media. The smugglers are using things like TikTok, and they've kind of got Bouza influencers who kind of say, well, I did it and I got to Europe and my life's great. Yay, you can too.
Is it happening with the complicity of state agents?
That is the suspicion. Proving it is one thing, but that is the general impression. There is no way that smugglers and human traffickers could get their boats out unless there is some complicity from coast guards who are allowing them through. But proving it, of course, is another thing.
And that's Elysia Falkman, a journalist in Tunisia. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Today is the 80th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz-Birkenau, the largest concentration and extermination camp in which more than 6 million Jews were murdered, alongside minorities like disabled people, Polish people, black people, Roma and Sinti people, and also queer people, among others. We're going to take a closer look at how black people, often forgotten victims of Nazi Germany, were treated by the Nazis who carried out the extermination policies. They were a mixture of resistance fighters, people who came to Europe as a result of colonialism, and worked as sailors, soldiers, performers, among other things. Black people were also abused in human zoos, put on display in the service of white supremacist thinking. Many Africans had fought on the side of German colonial forces on the continent during the First World War. And when that war ended in defeat for Germany, some of them moved to Germany. One of them was Mahjoub bin Adam Mohammed, also known as Bayoume Mohammed Hussein, who was murdered in Sachsenhausen concentration camp near Berlin. He initially lived a reasonably successful life in Berlin. So how did he end up in a concentration camp? Dr. Astrid Ley is director of the Sachsenhausen Memorial and Museum.
He was a prisoner of Sachsenhausen. He was brought to Sachsenhausen concentration camp in 1941. And it's a quite tragic story, his fate. He was born in what is today Tanzania. And his father worked for the German colonial forces there. Tanzania was Deutsch-Ostafrika. It was held by the Germans. And his father had quite a high rank as an askari in the German help troops. And even Bayoume, he was sent as a child soldier. He was forced to fight in the First World War. And like many people, after the Germans lost the colonies, after having lost the First World War, some of these people who have been servants of the Germans, they tried to get to Germany. And this is also what Bayoume did. He managed to get a job on a ship as a waiter and arrived in Germany in 1929, as far as I know. He tried all his life to please the Germans. He tried to do everything. He was working as a waiter, as he was even supporting these German claims for regaining the colonies. As soon as the Nazis were in power, the Germans started to claim the colonies back. Bayoume was kind of supporting this by giving classes in Swahili language at the Berlin University. And he, as an actor, he played in several, there were several movies. Quite well-known big movies who had this colonial setting in the German colonies, and he was playing the good guy always in this role.
So he went to Germany, actively works in Germany, actively works to regain German territory. So he is quite pro-German then, and even, would you say, pro-Nazi?
I wouldn't say that. Definitely somebody who was brought up in this imperialist time and politics and this conservative colonialism in Germany.
So how was he regarded? Because he did marry a German woman and also had an affair with another one and had children by both of them.
Yeah. Actually, he was sent to the concentration camp in 1941 only. For a long time, he had been married with this German woman since, I don't know, 1931 or something. For a long time. And the Nazis, they didn't show interest as long as he served their politics to claim the colonies back.
He wasn't the only black man in Germany or the only black victim. Do we know anything about their lives in Germany, how they managed to live? Were they able to live freely? Because that's a very fraught time in Germany.
Immediately after the Nazis came to power, it was like a night and fog campaign against children, the Rhineland children. These were children of German women with colonial soldiers from France. And these kids were taken, and without any legal basis, the National Socialists had them sterilized because they didn't want them to further reproduce. Black people were seen as a eugenic or a problem of racial hygiene in the understanding of the Nazis.
And that was similar to their understanding of Jewish people as well.
Jewish people were to be completely annihilated. I'm not sure whether this aim was so clearly defined in respect to people of color too. But this might just, it's probably just because there were not enough people of color in Germany.
I was quite interested in how the switch happened with Baume suddenly from one moment to the next. One moment he was married, even though his wife divorced him, but he lived in Germany. He was able to work and bring up his children. The next moment, he's subject to a sort of moral judgment and seen as unfit and ends up in a concentration camp. So I was just wondering, how was he regarded before that switch? How was he treated before that?
This is what I try to explain. These movies, they are like propaganda for give us back these colonies. And they, in the time of the war, these movies were very important because it withdrew the attention of the German population from this terrible war and allowed them to go to this beautiful lands of Africa for 2 hours in the cinema at least. And escape their reality. And on the other hand, always politically hammering it into their heads. This is our colonies. We need them back. And with this war against the Soviet Union, suddenly Nazis had to give up the plan to get the colonies back. They just gave it up in 1941. And from this moment, Bayume was not interesting for them anymore. And then he received the treatment that they wanted to give. They would have given him much earlier if they could have, but they didn't do it because they needed his collaboration.
Let's get back to the sterilization that you spoke about, the black children. I'm wondering, were they children when they were being sterilized, or were they the sons and daughters of mixed marriages or mixed relationships and them being sterilized? And where did that happen?
It was the children. It was actually, most of them were born in the time after the First World War, when the Rhineland was occupied by French troops. And among the occupation soldiers, there were soldiers from the French colonies. And like always, relationships come up. And so these kids were born in 1919, 1920. And in the time of 1937, when this sterilization campaign took place, they were 17. They were juveniles. The Nazis had a term of person dangerous in the means of reproduction. As long as somebody didn't reproduce himself, who was eugenically deemed to be inferior or not suitable, as long as they were sterilized and couldn't have children, they could live. This was not the question. It was different with Jewish people. For example, Jewish people were to be murdered. They were to be excluded from the German society as a whole because it was something special, that the politics was different. Even Sinti and Roma people, for a long time, were, as long as they were sterilized or as long as they didn't mix up with Germans, this was okay.
So with the people, the black victims in the concentration camps, mm-hmm. did they suffer the same fate as Jewish people who were in the camps?
Actually, they had a terrible fate because I read from Sachsenhausen testimonies of other prisoners. And we were brought to Sachsenhausen. We were a transport of, I don't know, 50 men. And among us was one black man. And then we had to line up at the roll call area. And luckily for the rest, all the attention of the SS and all the brutal treatment was directed towards this one black man because he was something special.
And that's what a survivor wrote, is it?
Yeah, this is what a survivor wrote. It shows that in a concentration camp, it was whenever you were somehow special, whether you wore glasses or you were extremely tall, but the SS was attracted and then started to mock them and to beat them. This is why it is so astonishing that Bayume actually survived for 3 years in the camp.
Is there now more of an effort to commemorating the life of Bayume and other forgotten black victims?
Yeah, Bayume, but he's a kind of an exception from this group of the African German prisoners. He was commemorated. There was a stumble stone laid for him, and a professor from Cologne University, she wrote a book about him. At this time, I worked together with her, so this is how I came across his biography.
Tell us what a stumbling stone is. And the German name is Stolpersteiner, right? It's something that you trip over almost, a stumbling stone, so that you have to look at it.
You stumble. You walk on your daily life, your daily routine, and you stumble over the stone and you stand there, you have a look at it, you read it, and you commemorate, you think. And so it's always put in front of the houses where these people lived and not in front of the concentration camp because he lived there, the last house that they had chosen by themselves that they wanted to live there. And when you walk through Berlin, there's hundreds of thousands of stumble stones, and it shows, and it started that they were put for Jewish prisoners. Now they are also for all kinds of concentration camp victims. So by seeing how many stones there are, you see how many victims there are.
That was Dr. Astrid Ley, director of the Sachsenhausen Memorial and Museum. Focus on Africa was pulled together by Yvette Twagira-Maria, Bella Hassan, and Amy Leibovitz here in London. Paul Bachibinga was the senior producer. Jack Graysmark, our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. Our sister podcast, Africa Daily, has been exploring how Africa's rural population can enjoy the benefits of electricity. I'm Audrey Brown. We'll talk again next time.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking, and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.